And right now I'm very happy to welcome to our program Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of the news website Mondo Weiss, which covers U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Philip, it's great to have you here. Thanks for making the time to join us this evening.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
If you could, just say a word about Mondo Weiss, the goals and sort of the mission of the group that you've been heading up.
Well, it's a website that I started actually as a personal blog pretty much after the Iraq War, which I had vigorously opposed inside the mainstream media, and which was not a very popular position inside the mainstream media then. And opposing the Iraq War led me in time as a Jew to being very concerned with our policy vis-a-vis Israel. I'd never been to Israel until I was 50 in 2006. And since that time, I have sort of developed a community or become part of a community that is generally extremely skeptical of Zionism, the need for a Jewish state in the Middle East, and the ways that that Israel is dependent on the United States for support. So that's where we're at. It's now a website with a few employees, and it's fulfilling a need in that I think a lot of Americans are question why the United States has to be so supportive of this country that discriminates against half its population.
Some big issues there, and I know there's been rising tensions and violence in Israel and in the Palestinian territories, especially in Jerusalem, and we've got so many other sort of hot-button issues that the media covers that
Yes. It
seems like now in particular our media is not paying much attention to what's going on there, and there's some important developments, and that's certainly one of the reasons I wanted to have you on here, because I know Mondo Weiss does fulfill an important need out there, given that our media really is pretty much one-dimensional when it comes to reporting on the news from Israel-Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe as we begin to explore this issue in some depth, summarize for our listeners briefly, if you would, the escalating tensions and violence in Jerusalem and the surrounding area since June 3rd, when three Israeli teenagers were abducted and killed while hitchhiking in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. And, of course, I think there's a lot that happened in between, but most of our listeners will recall that it was on November 18th, the latest incident involved the murder of four Jewish rabbis and an Israeli policeman in a synagogue in Jerusalem, and the two Palestinian assailants were shot and killed there. But there's a lot to cover, but maybe you can condense it sort of so we can understand the current situation and tension there.
Yes. Well, I think that we have to go back to the fact that the peace process broke down as of April. Last April, John Kerry sort of folded his hand. And so there's a wide recognition that the two-state solution, which a lot of people have been focused on for 25 years, has come to an end. And there's one state that controls the whole territory, and that's Israel. Jerusalem is a focus because Jerusalem was supposed to be Palestinian capital. It was supposed to be a shared city. And in recent months, it's become clearer than ever that, it's been clear to many for years, but it's been more evident to the world that Israel wants to fold Jerusalem into Israel, that it considers Israel the eternal capital of the Jewish people. And it has built settlements all around Jerusalem, and it's created a kind of a ghetto situation for those Palestinian neighborhoods inside Jerusalem. It's made it clear we want as few Palestinians as possible and as many Jews in Jerusalem. And you're talking about a city where obviously it's been the focus of religious people for centuries. And in fact, the person who started Zionism, political Zionism, in the late 1900s, Theodore Herzl promised that Jerusalem would be international. It should be an international city, and we see it controlled by Israel, and it's produced an enormous amount of tension. And I think the violence of the last few months has been has reflected a recognition by Palestinians that there's no place for us to go. They're closing in on, they're enclosing the city. We have few rights, and there have been a number of horrific incidents, yes, and the latest of which was that bloody attack on a synagogue in West Jerusalem.
Now, what's the role of the religious holy sites? I know there was an attack on a radical Jewish leader who was proposing that Jews should be able to pray in holy places that on a religious site that Islam holds holy.
Yeah.
And
what
role did that play in escalating tensions?
Well, there are a number of right-wing Israeli politicians who have said that Jews should have the right to pray and even to rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount, what Jews call the Temple Mount, which Muslims refer to as the Haram al-Sharif, or Noble Sanctuary, because that's where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, which is the third most holy site in Islam. So this site is one that is historically somewhat contested, although now it's the site of a mosque, a great mosque. And so this declaration by various right-wing religious zealots that we want to pray up there, Jews want to pray up there, we want to rebuild our temple up there and destroy the mosque, have been extremely they're volatile, they're dangerous, they've created an overcharged atmosphere, and even Netanyahu has at times tried to, the Prime Minister of Israel has tried to turn down the temperature on this, but I think that that has played this kind of religious, people always say, hey, don't let a political conflict become a religious conflict, because then you've got two great religions battling each other. Well, this conflict has a big religious overtones, and it relates to this holy site, these holy sites.
Philip Weiss is our guest tonight, founder and co-editor of the news website Mondo Weiss, which covers U.S. foreign policy in particular in the Middle East. And Philip, there have been more than a handful of commentators who are looking at the situation in the Middle East and noting with the two-state solution at a dead end that the situation there, the environment, is ripe for a third intifada. And I'm wondering if you would provide some insight into what you think will be happening here, given that a negotiated settlement seems to be off the table at this moment, and there's rising frustration among the Palestinians with more Jewish settler housing units
yes.
being built all the time, with the
yes.
United States seemingly unable to prevent the rising number of these settlements
yeah.
in the Palestinian territories. What is happening among the Palestinians from your reading of things in terms of the possibility of a third major intifada or uprising?
Well, I interviewed a lot of Palestinians about this very question last month when I was over there, and I was told that the violence we're seeing is not yet an uprising, that the intifadas, 1987 and 2000, were organized uprisings across Palestine with strong leadership. What we've seen so far is sporadic violence of a very obviously angry but by frustrated individuals, by and large, who have been so angered by, say, a threat to the Temple Mount or to the Al-Aqsa Mosque that they go off. And I think that, so I don't think we're at the point of an intifada. And in fact, some have said that Israel has so sewn up the Palestinian territories, soldiers and police are all over the West Bank, and there are walls here and checkpoints and barbed wire. Gaza itself is a open air prison. That the ability of the Palestinians to rise up as one is starkly limited. And so I don't think there's an intifada yet. There could well be one. I mean, the last intifada came about in part because the peace process had failed. And once again, we're at a point where the peace process has failed and where young Palestinians are looking at a future of where they can see the Mediterranean Sea from the top of their house, but they can never go to that sea. The Palestinians on the West Bank are not allowed to go to the Mediterranean. without a special permit. They're not allowed to go into Jerusalem to this Muslim holy site without a special permit. So these you have several million people, 4 or 5 million people living under occupation and with no hope of freedom, and it's obviously an extremely dangerous situation.
Philip, I wanted to further ask you about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his position here. When he speaks, does he recognize the death of the two-state solution? And what is his reaction to a very inflammatory statement recently by Netanyahu's foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who now openly says that he wants to pay Palestinians who are living in Israel to leave the country? In other words, he wants to use money, basically, to conduct an ethnic cleansing of a sort.
Yes. I don't know. I haven't seen a Netanyahu response to that proposal as such. I think that what's true of all these right-wing politicians is that their base is on the right, and it's driving them further and further right. Israeli society is on the right, is going further and further right, and there's no governor on it. You know, at least in our political process, you know, you might object to some of the right-wing Republican positions during the primary portion of the campaign, but then when the general election happens, they have to appeal to a wider group of people whom they hope to govern. In Israel, they're only appealing to the right wing because they can form a coalition. They have to form a coalition out of the right wing, and half the population, the Palestinians, are not represented in the either in the governing coalition or they can't vote. So there isn't that kind of tempering process that a real democracy would have, and you have these right-wing zealots who are driving the political process. And these are weak people. Netanyahu, I think, is a very weak leader who has pandered to that right wing. In order to maintain his position as prime minister, he's pandered to that right wing by not tamping down some of this religious zealotry with respect to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And so he's let this stuff get out of control. He's built that fire. The savage attack on Gaza this summer, which really has achieved nothing in the end, was again a sort of a had a political purpose because it satisfied the right wing, which is somewhat suspicious of Netanyahu. It's a really grim political situation there, and structurally it's grim.
Philip Weiss is our guest, founder and co-editor of the news website Mondo Weiss, and we'll be giving you the web address there and letting you know some of the resources in a little bit. But, Philip, what about the Obama administration? Since John Kerry failed to restart negotiations on a two-state solution some months ago, it seems that the Obama administration has been able to do very little in terms of stopping the building of these, 2,600 new settlements in Palestinian territory, and it seems like the United States really has, just taking a read from the public statements, it seems like they've given up.
I think that you're right, and that Obama, in fact, this is a highly interpretive read on it, but I think that when Obama went to Israel and Palestine in 2013, you remember he was under a lot of pressure to go over there. He gave a big speech in March of 2013, and he said, here's the deal. This is what you have to do to make peace. This status quo is unsustainable. You cannot govern 4.5 million people who have no right to vote and expect that they're going to accept that type of occupation forever. And he said, you got to withdraw this, end the settlement process, withdraw, create a two-state. He said he laid it out what he thought his vision was, and the interpretation none of that is an interpretation. Those are facts that he did that. What's interpretive is I think that at that time Obama said, "Here's the deal: take it or leave it. And if you can't do it, then I'm walking away from this." And I think that that is actually what Obama has done. He said, "I've got bigger fish to fry. I'm sick of being lectured by Netanyahu, and I find it humiliating. I want as little to do as I can with this problem. I have to get engaged because there's a lot of political money in supporting Israel, and I have to keep the Democratic Party viable and keep do the best for my successor. But personally, I'm not going to spend another ounce of capital on this. And John Kerry put a lot of energy into the peace process, and Obama backed him up somewhat, but didn't really throw his weight behind it. And I think the best that anyone can hope at this point is that the next time there's a Security Council resolution that condemns Israel for the settlements, this time the United States won't veto it. It might just abstain and let it go through.
And what message would that send Israel? And I guess to the key point here, is the current situation sustainable? It seems like people like Benjamin Netanyahu thinks that it is, and his political base on the right inside Israel also thinks that the current occupation of Palestinian land and the control of 4 to 5 million Palestinians is sustainable. Is it?
Well, many Israelis hold that view, that managed conflict is the answer, and we can continue to do this. We've done it almost 50 years, or almost 68 years, 67 years. We've always managed to get as much land for Jews as we can and push Palestinians off and used violence to maintain our position. When I go over there, I just find it so bleak. The future looks so bleak that it's clear that the only thing that is going to resolve this is going to be great violence, and that it's inevitable there'll be great, in my view, that it's inevitable that there will be great violence. I don't think it is sustainable, but, I could be wrong. Maybe it could go on for another few decades. It will certainly be a terribly unjust situation. I think the good news is that there's an international awakening to this problem. It obviously fuels a lot of Islamic radicalism across the Middle East. Even ISIS derives support from the fact that the United States is on Israel's side tirelessly, just as Osama bin Laden cited this as a major motivation for his terrorist acts. So there's a global awakening. I think that's the best we can hope, that there will be more and more pressure on Israel, more and more isolation of Israel because of its conduct.
What about the influence of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee? There's been more written about their influence in Congress in a more open fashion than we've seen in recent decades. But yet they seem to still maintain an enormous amount of influence, and I'll bet with a new Republican majority in the Senate and the Republicans in control of both houses of Congress in January that we're going to see AIPAC have even more power in terms of influencing U.S. policy in Israel.
Well, to be glass half full, I agree with you, Scott, that we've seen more open coverage of the AIPAC than ever before, and that's a great sign. I think also the fact that the Republicans are so wed to AIPAC and the Christian Zionist lobby as well means that at last there might be space on the Democratic side to oppose AIPAC. There's growing space on the Democratic side, I think, to be opposed to the Israel lobby. We will see, but I think that more and more Americans are becoming aware of the issue. I'm optimistic that we're going to see some divorce from the Israel lobby at last happening, that you can't maintain power, the degree of power that the lobby has had for the last 25, 30, 40 years as consistently, especially as the press begins to notice.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, shorthand is the BDS movement.
Yes.
How much influence has the BDS movement been able to, how much has the BDS movement been able to really move government policy around the world? Obviously, it's not had too much effect here in the United States,
yeah.
But there are other countries that these BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, have really made inroads. Maybe you can speak to
that. Yes. I think BDS has had a huge impact, but I take your point. It's had very little influence so far in the United States beyond Palestinian solidarity campuses. In Europe, it is having some influence. It's part of a movement in Europe for governments to, in some cases, sanction Israel, for large corporations to withdraw from Israel. I think that it was a while ago a State Department official warned Israel that it would face a tsunami of international isolation if it continued the settlement project, and that is what is happening. The BDS represents the a nonviolent means of people around the world, for people around the world to register their objection to the condition of Palestinians. And to my way of thinking, it's reminiscent of the 1820s through the 1850s as slavery fell around the world. That there was a real grassroots movement in that case. There's a grassroots movement here. There was grassroots movements for civil rights in the United States, obviously, and other great liberations. So, again, striking that optimistic note, I think that BDS represents that public pressure from the grassroots up that will have a large impact, even in the United States someday.
Philip, my last question here, and it's a complex one, and you will have to sort of give it short shrift at this point. We don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you about U.S. public opinion. We had our news media covering this summer's Israeli attacks on civilians and the Hamas government in Gaza like never before. I mean, it was 24/7 coverage, and when buildings were blown up, there was live television cameras trained on the people, the civilians scattered, the children that were being killed in United Nations compounds. How much effect do you think more comprehensive coverage of that Israeli attack on Gaza than we've seen in some time, how much do you think that's impacted U.S. public opinion?
Well, I think that the effect has been subtle. I agree with you that it's been a remarkable change in coverage, and I'm grateful for that, that finally the mainstream is paying attention to what I consider to be atrocities and massacres. That being said, I think that it's beginning to bite in terms of young Democrats. And that's where the polling shows people turning away from Israel. And that is the light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the Israel lobby and in terms of U.S. policy, is that when you ask people of color, when you ask women, when you ask young Democrats how they feel about Israel, the favorable numbers are the unfavorable numbers are in some cases higher than the favorable numbers. I think I'm sorry I don't have this at the tips of my fingers, but I believe that it's remarkably higher unfavorable numbers for young Democrats and people of color, and even for women it shifts to an unfavorable view of Israel. So that's where there has been some impact, and that's why I think the Democratic Party is the place where these public opinion changes will begin to manifest themselves. We'll finally see someone running for Congress who's taken seriously, who says, I want to end American support for Israel in view of the occupation.
Well, we're out of time, Philip, and I thank you for a thoroughgoing discussion.
I thought your questions were excellent and very well informed. Thanks, Scott.
Philip, before you go, do give our listener just a quick thumbnail of the resources available on Mondo Weiss and the web address as well.
We try to keep up on the news over there and over here on the Israel-Palestine question. MondoWeiss.net. You can find it easily online and. If you like it, stick around. We try to be reasonable. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you so much, Philip. Take care. Bye bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye. That's Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of the news website Mondo Weiss, and we hope you'll visit and check out the articles there. A lot of informed commentary on Middle East issues you're not liable to see very many other places in the U.S. corporate media. So that's a place to stop.